Chastity Hobbs.
Mike Matamore.
Jeff Champ.
Dan Lucas.
Tom Wozlevac.
Okay.
In case you didn't hear, it's March 28th. Because
I don't think I turned it on the first time.
Well, we have kind of three things today.
Okay.
Just kind of to report back on three things. Well, actually, a couple things that we are talking about. You know, we opened Invention and Works.
Yeah.
And I don't have an Invention and Works article for you yet, but okay. Generally, what we're looking at is just trying to make it come into compliance with our reading of the federal statute, which is the BAYH, the Bah Dole Act.
Dole, D-O-Y-L-E?
I think it's D-O-L-E, like Bob Dole.
Oh, Bob Dole. Oh, yeah, that makes sense. And Evan Bah, maybe?
Yeah, I think it's Evan Bah and Bob Dole. So obviously this isn't an act that came out yesterday.
I'm glad we're up on our compliances.
Yeah. Yeah, this is to replace the Lincoln Act, I guess. The Now, I'm told by in the course of all of that did you raise the issue, I think, information tech, like distance
online
learning,
courses? Yeah, online that's courses. That's what was our right. interest in it. So we opened it too.
We want to say, we'll tell you that if you want to negotiate that in 10.9, because right now I think in 10.9 is where we have that distance learning. Instructional technology.
Oh, okay. Interesting. Okay.
We don't mind opening this.
Okay.
Mutually.
Okay.
So, because we think this is the place that we might want to put it.
Okay.
All right? So, do you get that, Tom?
Which article?
It's 10.9. Nobody opened it.
Yeah.
Right.
But we're willing to...
So, instead of Article 20, is that what you're...
I think we're going to do Article 20 anyway because we're going to update it because we think it's out of compliance with the statute. But in terms of online courses, if that is more appropriately found in 10.9, we're okay putting
okay.
without somebody having to...
We have, of course, as bargaining teams have the right to do that. By mutual agreement, we could open it. And also, if that ends up being the case, we'll have to look at the specific language and kind of see where it might fall on those terms. But it would certainly be under a limited scope. It would not be that the entire article is open.
Yeah, no, we're just saying if we want to...
Great. I think that's thoughtful. Thank you, Mike.
Okay. Good. And the other thing that we wanted to report back on is we have a concern about the language you proposed in Article 26 and Section 1009.264, paren 4, which is a state statute. I think it's a statute on the... I think it says how you have tuition-free waivers. I think that's tuition waivers.
This is a Florida statute, not in the contract.
Okay. It's a Florida statute. And it's... I'll try to pull it up.
I Like, you don't carry around hard copies of all the Florida statutes? Like, big buying.
It's fee waivers.
Oh, okay.
So, we don't have a, we're looking at that.
Okay.
And
we're, do you think their definition of fees is separate from tuition? Like, you know, I mean, fees has a, in the academic context, has a specific understanding, right? It's the fees are the cost in addition to, like, tuition.
Yeah, well, we have to look at this, but it talks about waiving tuition too.
It does too, okay.
Yeah, like, okay. It says, for example, this just caught my eye. It says, a Florida college system institution may waive any portion of the tuition. It's like, I'm looking, tuition and fees charged to a student who qualifies for the out-of-state waiver under this subsection may not exceed the tuition. So it does address tuition.
Okay.
So I think we all need to take a look at this.
As it applies to what? I guess that's the part of
Well, there was a plan to have, like, a bank of tuition waivers, basically.
Yeah, okay. that you would, for
faculty.
Essentially that they would be able to bank unused ones annually. Gotcha. In a similar way that sick leave works. So they could accrue a stronger benefit over time.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
So the question is, would, since they, in 109.26, it sets out when you can, how you can waive tuition. There's a concern that what's proposed wouldn't be within the parameters of this law.
Okay, and we're flexible. I mean, we can certainly talk about different possibilities.
Good. All right. That's our response to 20 and 26.
Okay. On 25, we had the language about the payment of overloads. Remember that, and currently out of OPS, this is, you know, we have agreements on hold on this to try and
I don't have response to this today, but I expect to next time.
Okay.
They told me that there's still some conversation going on. Yeah.
Okay.
But we have that ongoing.
The only other question we had was about the university's position on that end of the year, how to incentivize graduation, right? And we were asking about if, because the departments receive funds based on unanimous attendance, right? And so we had two questions on that, like the contractually related one, CBA related explicitly, is if it does, the language that the university provided does not define what 100% attendance means, right? And so we were asking that if a faculty member is on sanctioned university leave connected to the CBA, if they're on sabbatical in Columbia or something, right? Certainly it would be our reading that they would be excused from that 100% attendance, right? There wasn't clarity on that in the language from the university. And secondarily, we were asking if our understanding is that those would be funds that would be provided to the department, not that those would be a specific wage distributed to the faculty member, right? And specifically how those sources of funds, how they would be used, you know, and whether or not we would need to review that for connection to the collective bargaining agreement.
Okay. I don't have an answer to those questions. I have both of those questions in my notes. Mm-hmm. And so I you know, we walked away with it. But I'll get that for you as soon as I possibly can.
Okay.
You know, relating to the clarification of what constitutes 100% attendance and how the funding for this incentive program would work is not something we intend to, I guess, put into the contract.
Yeah.
I'll see if I can get an answer prior to our next session, so it doesn't have to wait to a collective bargaining session, because you're really asking us for for a clarification of a program.
I was going to say the same thing. Yeah, it doesn't have to wait to bargain. If you guys just want to send us your clarification on that position, absolutely.
Good. I'll do that. We'll do that.
We have a couple of additional things. About, do you have other things?
That's all I have. Unfortunately, when we set this date, some of my team members were pulled to the bog meeting today.
Literally into the bog. Yeah.
Into the bog.
Yeah. Well, that's good, because we were setting expectations way too high last time. On time, productive.
Yeah. Yeah.
At our meeting last time, relating to Article 20 and inventions and works, you know, I mentioned our interest in is looking at online courses, right, and the works and inventions and how it relates to those deal items. When we wrote faculty and just provided our bargaining update, we relayed that to them that are interested in that and solicited back their feedback on their experiences with online courses and shells, how they're distributed, those sort of things. And so we synthesized our feedback from them and put it together really into a working document.
Okay.
Sometimes in the past when we've been talking about larger structural changes to the contract, it's been helpful to talk kind of first in kind of broader terms, working document terms, and then before converting to contract language, and like Mike says, deciding which article to put it into, those sort of things. So we have a working document that essentially summarizes and outlines. It's pretty close to what we believe would ultimately be contract language, but it's in a working document form now. And stop me at any point. I'll just kind of walk through this
for
clarification. The central issue that we hear frequently from faculty is is that a stop or a?
No. Oh, okay. No, it's just a. There was a random hand movement.
Okay. The central issue that we hear frequently from faculty is this issue of online courses, are they designed for programmatic use that can be distributed across the university that the university has authority to, or for individual use, right? And so what we're proposing is that starting in 2019-2020, that a faculty-created online course, inclusive of all content, shall be designated officially as intended for either programmatic use or for individual use beginning in the 2019-2020 academic year, right? For online courses designated for individual use, the faculty member who created the course shall retain all rights to the faculty-created course content. For online courses designated for programmatic use, the university shall retain all rights to the created course content and may use the course and materials at the university's discretion. Right? This would be a shell and content that a faculty member has created at the university. They can distribute to other faculty. They can use it however they want within the university. The creation of an online course by a faculty member shall be voluntary and at the discretion of the faculty member. Beginning in the 2019-2020 academic year, a contract for the creation of an online course by a faculty member for programmatic use shall be reduced to writing and provided to the faculty member with sufficient time for the faculty member's voluntary acceptance or rejection. Such contracts and their terms shall not be offered or applied arbitrarily, inconsistently, or capriciously. Right? So, for example, if the university wants a faculty member to use his or her expertise and create a course shell for a specific course, let's say in business or healthcare or something like this, and that course is intended to be at the discretion of the university to retain the rights to that content of that course, there needs to be a contract written up on the front end, right, that clarifies the compensation of the faculty member, the rights to it, the terms, which that faculty member can then voluntarily accept or reject. This is a model similar to what's currently done with our overloads compensations, right, that their faculty members voluntarily provided a contract on the front end and decides whether or not to accept or reject that contract, right?
Okay.
For the work that's already been created, all online courses created by faculty members prior to the 2019-2020 academic year shall be deemed for individual use unless previously and expressly designated as intended for programmatic use in a written contract between the university and faculty member. A faculty member may negotiate the transition of a course from individual use to programmatic use, but such a transition will be at the discretion of the faculty member, and the new programmatic course contract shall be negotiated and voluntarily entered into between the faculty member and institution. Importantly, should the faculty member participate in a university-sanctioned, funded or unfunded, and or voluntary or required certification program for an online course, such participation shall not constitute the faculty member's use of university-supported efforts. Currently, faculty who create online courses are required to participate in a certification process. It's the Quality Matters program. And so we believe there needs to be clarity in the contract that that does not constitute the use of official university resources if it's a required certification structure. And then lastly, upon separation from the university, a faculty member shall retain the rights to the content of any course designated for individual use created by the faculty member. So we hope that these are structures and guidelines would provide clarity on these two paths and on the rights and privileges related to those online courses.
Jonathan, would you advise me again of the certification program that's currently in place?
It's called Quality Matters.
Okay. Right?
And so it's a review program for certification. I think you can get like a provisional approval for an online course, but it has to be certified by a certain time. And these are frequently funded, you know, a small amount, like $500 or something like that. For that participation, but because that's a university-required component for any online course, right? We're seeing that that's different, certainly in spirit, from what it means of using university-sourced resources.
Okay.
So the actual QM certification is not required of all faculty, but mm-hmm. a university deemed similar to QM certification is required. Mm-hmm. Like in our college, it's not the official QM, but the college came up with their own certification that is similar to that. So that distinction is probably important.
Yeah, absolutely.
The QM is like, for example, there's no funds to support any QM certification within the Hal-Marcus College right now. Mm-hmm. And so it's not necessarily just QM, but it's that online certification that each of the colleges are deciding that is related to QM. Mm-hmm. So.
All right. So there's multiple certification programs.
It's mm-hmm. in the vein of the Quality Matters certification, but not officially Quality Matters.
Okay, got it.
For right now.
Why is it different?
The actual Quality Matters certification takes a little bit more time to go through, and while we're in this transition, at least this is my understanding, while we're in this transition with Canvas. The university kind of put a halt on that official QM certification process and created a streamlined internal one that has all of the accessibility and kind of legal things that have to be within that to have those be covered by the online courses.
Okay.
Probably indefinitely until that Canvas shift is over.
Absolutely. Yeah. And so in a sense, these are kind of two separate but interrelated issues that we're trying to address, I think, with this language. Like, the first is, you know, we've heard from faculty that they have felt at times that courses that they create individually are potentially taken away from them and used programmatically, right? And so that's problem one that we're trying to solve here with formally differentiating a programmatic course shell from an individual course shell, right? The second potential problem that we're trying to solve is making sure to clarify that a required certification program, whether Quality Matters or college initiated, does not constitute the use of university supported efforts as it's defined in Article 20.
Okay. Does anybody have any questions?
I do not.
I don't either, that I haven't already asked. Looking at this proposal, I think it raises issues for 20 and it raises issues for 10.9.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Okay, good. We'll take that back.
Okay.
Is there anything else that you have for us?
That's everything we have. You know, Article 3 is open, and you know, we'll return to the same kind of standard.
Okay.
Proposal.
Okay, good. All right. So I'm going to get an answer for the funding issue on the incentive for graduation and also how someone attains 100% participation.
Okay. Okay. Mike, I don't know if you have it in front of me. Could you tell us a little bit about the Bob Doyle Act, or like what you see is out of compliance, or
about, you know, Patton primarily?
What's that?
About Patton primarily, life and
Patton. Yeah. Actually, you know, the intellectual property, which is what's behind inventions and works, has gone through a lot of changes. I think there is the Bob Doyle Act, which is has kind of weighed in on how universities own property and how they share the ownership of property and who has the right of control. There was a Supreme Court case maybe 5-6 years ago that kind of shook everything up. And after that, there's been a lot of sort of fallout from that. I forget the name of the case. It escapes me now, but it's one of the big pharmaceutical companies. Mm-hmm. It's like Squibb or Bayer. Mm-hmm. Flonase, I don't know. And I think what happened was a faculty member had been working at Stanford for a long time, took a sabbatical, went to a lab of a pharmaceutical, brought all of his 10 years of work from Stanford into the lab, signed something saying, I'm waiving my rights and I'm waiving the university's rights, and then the pharmaceutical company said, "Well, we own this product,"
right. Mm-hmm.
And the Stanford University said, "No, you don't. You know, this has all been our effort, our support, our faculty member." And I think they said the faculty member can't waive our rights. So the thing that the faculty member signed is worthless. And I think the Supreme Court, see, I'm not an intellectual property lawyer. If at some point somebody had gone on strike or sued somebody for discrimination, then I would know. But I think the Supreme Court came down on the side of the pharmaceutical company and said that the there was nothing, Stanford had nothing that limited the faculty member from waiving everyone's rights.
So it was a Board of Trustees of Leland Stanford Junior University versus Roche Molecular System Incorporated.
There you go.
That's why we have a librarian.
Yeah, does not automatically vest title to inventions resulting from research funded by the federal government and federal contractors such as university. An individual researcher can deprive a federal contractor, such as a university, of the ownership of federal-funded invention by unilaterally transferring his.
See, and Tom always says, "I don't know what I'm talking about."
Yeah. So basically, you just want to take this language and put it in the contract.
I don't know what the intellectual property people at the University of Florida are.
Good. Right.
I know that. I'll say this much. At the University of West Florida, they put in the contract language in the collective bargaining agreement that says no faculty member can waive the rights of the university to products done with university support.
The Gatorade, let's just go back to that.
The Gatorade. Yeah, well, it was post-Gatorade, but Gatorade, yeah. They made a lot of money off Gatorade.
Yeah.
Daniel, you might correct me, but they say this in Tallahassee, but the patent that resulted in the greatest amount of funding to a university is at Florida State.
Tax law. Made tons of money.
Because you know what Taxol is? You know what he invented?
It was a cancer drug, right?
Yeah, but you know what he invented, the guy invented? Mm-hmm. Taxol, the cancer drug, existed before him. He didn't discover Taxol. But Taxol requires a element from a very rare plant that they couldn't mass produce. They couldn't find a way of mass producing this, you know, it's like Jerusalem plant. I think it's called the Jerusalem plant.
Yeah.
And he came up with the synthetic of the Jerusalem plant.
Wow. Yeah.
And they made $200 million. From Florida State made $200 million.
Yeah, and I bet you he got more than $250 too.
He did get more than $250. He's very wealthy. He lives in Tallahassee.
Yeah, I was gonna say he made a ton of money personally.
Yes, he did. So, yeah, he did.
That's why I guess he's probably a retired professor now.
he was gonna build a pay to build a new chemistry building at Florida State.
They did build one.
He took his money away. We gave him his money back. Because he put a condition on the building that the building had to have a dedicated, gated parking lot for the faculty. and Florida State wouldn't do it. Florida State said, no, we won't take that, because they go, we don't have gated things for any of our faculty. So we're not going to treat our chemistry faculty differently.
You would think they would want to gate it and lock it in.
Yeah, that's
keep them there.
That's true. Have you ever, that's
no,
true.
I didn't know that. There's a gated parking lot beside that building. I don't know if it's, you know, you obviously have to have
it says no chemistry faculty allowed.
You're not with the chemistry department. You won't be done.
Okay. I'm going to stop for
okay.
One second. All right. Well, we'll wait for